All right, have a good evening. Tonight is January 7th, 2017. We were off last week because of Hanukkah. This is the eighth, if I'm not mistaken, the eighth in this year's series, the 1300s. And first, a quick apology is I'm really at the mercy of the media center here at Taras Chaim. Well, first of all, to thank them for all of the equipment, but this is the second time that they gave me this projector. This projector, I guess, is the secondary projector. It's older, so it doesn't fit into my computer because my computer only has USB, you know, connections. And this does not even have a USB connection. It was probably out before USBs. So it doesn't fit into my computer, so I'm using their computer. And the last time when I had this, the color did not come out well. So I hope I don't have too much color. Or I hope the color comes out clear enough. That's the first.
The good news is your lecture and the color commentary that you give us of the historical period comes out in color.
Okay, so the color commentary may not be affected. Okay, that could be. Just that's the one with the... Okay, okay, so finally, this is the first week that I think we're actually getting up to the 1300s. Up until now, we were doing various things before the 1300s. This is a... As you can see over here, it's called the, I don't know who coined it that, but the calamitous 14th century. And it really was. This is, I guess, when you talk about the Middle Ages, it usually goes, let's say, from the 1100s to the 1500s. So this is the first half was seemingly the good part. You know, it's funny to think about the Crusades being the good part, but... Europe was at a time of growth. Europe was at a time of, there was food, there was growth, and things were happening. Things overall were in a positive setting. From this point on, this century of the 1300s is going to be horrific. One thing after another. And tens of millions of people in this century are going to die, going to be killed and died. And things are not really, Europe is not going to get back to itself until the 1500s. So I guess we could start. What we've done so far is even before, just going back when we spoke about the Jews of England, so the Jews of England were kicked out of England in 1291. So in 1291, there were no more Jews of England. I guess that's sort of one of the previews or the introductions into the 1300s. Okay, so if you just a quick geography, you can see many in 1300 there were many little countries and little states. I guess England was one of the bigger ones. France, but even France wasn't as unified as it will be at the end of the century. Spain was into four or five parts. You had in the 1300s, you had the Moors or the Muslims in the south, and Portugal and Castile, Aragon, Navarone. Spain was not unified as a country till the end of the 1400s, 1492. Here there are some major states at the time: England, Sweden, France, Austria, Scotland, Portland. Things that did not exist, as we know, was Spain, Italy, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, the Low Countries, Russia, and the Byzantine Southeast Europe. And this is where, coming into the 1300s, these are the players, or these are the states, and this is what it would look like. It's 1328, a different type of map, but just maybe starting to get a little more together. And this is in the 1400s. Just, I guess, smaller states. Somehow, over the century, states started getting bigger and stronger. Here you would have, It's a new clicker. My last one finally went out, so I have a new to get used to the buttons on this one. You got still England, Scotland, but Portugal now becomes France. At the end, at 1400, is in smack in the middle of the Hundred Years' War, which hopefully we'll get to tonight. Austria, Ottoman Empire comes to. It's still Spain, Italy, Germany, and Russia. These are not the way we have them today. In what way was it bad? So let's, I guess, start with the Great Famine. It was a famine in 1315 through 1317. I guess 2-3 years of no food. I guess it was I don't know if it was just the weather thing but there was a very, very poor crop in the year 1315 and the year 1316. So you had 2 years of no food. Finally, you needed 1317 to get things going until 1318. So you had like about 2-3 years of no food. And it really took Europe, it's really sometimes known by 1322, because it took Europe about another 5 years to catch up, you know, with no food for 2 years. It affected the most of Europe, and it did over these 5 years, over these seven years, it caused millions of deaths. Today, I guess we have governments are much better at, you know, helping, you know, getting food from other countries. When Russia had there recently in the past 20, 30 years, when they had their famine, so they bought grain from the United States, right? I think up until the 70s, there was the United States had a system where it had a two, three-year system where the grain went to the old, and they always used 2-3-year-old grain. And so Yashin was not as much of a problem here in America, right? I think, and then when they started selling grain to Russia, so they were using up a lot of the supplies, it wasn't so sure that it wasn't from the old grain.
Maybe that's why God did it, so that we wouldn't have that problem.
So now it's a different issue, but less of a problem. Maybe it was a problem anyway, but right. But now it's, I'm not sure what they have, but I guess just the point is that the United today, I guess governments are more capable of handling famines. Maybe they are. You see all these pictures of African, third world African countries, but even then they have the United Nations and all these international relief organizations. But then in Europe there was nothing. I mean, there was, you know, and it caused, it wreaked havoc. It was a bad weather, 1315. So you could imagine if there's no food, so that leads to crime, disease, death, cannibalism, infanticide. And it was consequences for everybody, church, state, European society, future calamities. And of course the Jews were in and among all this was happening. Whatever happens in Europe is going to happen to the Jews as well. Another thing is inflation. I mean, this place where I saw it had like 800% inflation. So, like, I guess if you had a cookie for $1.25, it's going to cost $10 for that cookie. I mean, just, you know, who could afford that? One of the causes was in 1303 and 1306 to 1307, the Baltic, it was so cold in Europe. I guess it was, they call it a mini ice age. I don't know, global warming, global cooling. I don't know if you had the liberals back then, you know, screaming climate change. I don't know what they were doing then, but
global warming.
You know, but they had the Baltic Sea actually froze over for those 3 years. So, you know, I guess I don't know if Europe was getting colder back then, but it was like that's 1306, 1307, I guess within 10 years of these crops. Okay, well, what else happens when there's a famine? Diseases go up, people get married later, population goes down, homeless. One big thing is that rich farmers buy out poor farmers, because poor farmers, they can't afford, so the rich farmers, they have a little, let's say, I guess, more assets, so they could weather it out a little better and they could buy out the poor farmers, unemployment. And also another big thing is the migration of men to towns, because if there's nothing doing in the farming area, so where are you going to go? You're going to go to the towns, which is going to lead to more crime, more unemployment, more overcrowding, less sanitary conditions. I guess keep this in mind, 1322, when the bubonic plague is going to hit 22 years later, so it's like ripe for a disaster. Government didn't know. Okay, I just quoted this out of a book, and I forgot to write what book I got it from. But basically, why did I do this? Because it just brought the fact that, you know, while these were happening, so you have to realize the Jews were in the money lending business. So if you're lending money to farmers and there's no food, you know, for the farmers to sell to pay your loans back, so what do you do? And if they don't have food, I mean, it just, the whole economy crashes. So it just brought down that the Jews had to adjust. You know, if you're lending money on interest, so what do? You have to, you know, fix up your terms. Do you extend the loan? Do you drop the interest? Do you increase the interest? Do you increase the loans? What do you do? Do you defer? So that was something that the Jews during this time had to readjust their own dealings. So I guess the Jews were affected, if nothing else, if no money is coming in, like everything, all segments of society. Okay, in 1306, that was the one thing. Now we have something else also, which was before. This is in 1306, King Philip of France. So two things happened. First of all, he was in a war with Belgium, or Flemish, right? And secondly, is some sort of currency change. I don't know if they were going to a different standard, but because of those two reasons, he needed a lot of money, and he needed a lot of money quickly. So what do you do? What are one of the ways, if you need a lot of money quickly? You take your Jews and you expel them and you just take all their money, which is what King Philip decided to do. Now, keep in mind, again, at this point, before the Hundred Years' War, France and England were almost like sister countries. They were like, you know, England all came from Normandy, which was part of France, and it was all a... it was like, you know, sister countries. They're all from the same background, the same culture. So in England, I just mentioned before, 1291, Jews were kicked out. Many of the Jews ended up in France in 1306. And now they're going to be thrown out of England, France in 1306. Okay, so you have there are no Jews in England anymore. And now the Jews in France are going to be kicked out in 1306. Okay. What he did this time is he didn't tell the Jews, and they did it secretly. The Jews did not know what hit them. And all of a sudden, the day after Tisha B'Av, I think it was, the day after Tisha B'Av, they did not see it coming, and they gathered all 100,000 Jews who were arrested all at the same time. They didn't know to run, to hide their money. They didn't know anything. They didn't know anything what was coming up. Plan was kept secret, and they kicked them all out of France. This is what King Philip did in 1306. I guess this is one of the years also the things got colder, right? That was 1306, 1307, and we said the Baltic Sea froze over, so Europe was in some sort of it was very colder there. It could have been also, you know, it could have affected the crops as well. It doesn't necessarily mean it was a famine, but weather does play a part. Okay, so they took all the Jews and they arrested them, and they said, you got to leave by a certain date, and if you don't, then we can kill you. Right? That's usually what happens. That's usually what happens when The other thing is now they had all the property of the Jews, and they had the land and the property of the Jews, and the king now has to sell it for cash. That took a little bit longer, even though they got everything right away. So it took a few years. By 1315, which is about 9 years later, they were still trying to sell everything. In 1315, he was succeeded by Louis, his son. I don't know which Louis this was. I'm not sure if the fourth, fifth, but one of the Louis was in 1315. He came into power and he said, "All right, Jews can come back."
So where did the Jews go?
So great question. They probably migrated east. Now in France, France was like, there was a major part of France, but you had like little areas around France that weren't under the King of France, like Flanders, Brittany, Poitiers, certain areas, Agincourt. I'm not sure, because those were under England and maybe they couldn't be there. But there were different areas in France that weren't really under the French king. They were under French vassals. So I don't know exactly what the relationship. They called themselves French, but the nobles there wanted, they had a certain amount of autonomy. So the Jews could have gone to those areas. But the main area, which included Paris, the main area of France, all the Jews were kicked out of.
None of them went to Spain at this point from there?
Yes, absolutely. Many of them could have gone to Spain. As a matter of fact, 1322, so they came back in 1315 by Louis, and then again 7 years later they were thrown out again. In 1322, by that time, the Rush, I think we mentioned this last time, the Rush was, who was in Germany, who was the leader of German Jewry, he felt it wasn't safe for him to stay in Germany. He was afraid that they would take him for the and they hold him responsible for the money that wasn't raised for his Rebbe, Rav Meir of Rottenburg. So the Rush fled to Spain ahead of many, many French Jews that came after him in the expulsions. So so they did go to Spain, or they went to Germany. They started moving east. Okay, so now we have, they were expelled in 1306 from France, again accepted back in 1315, and then again expelled again in 1322. And this is, now, in 1322, what ended up happening is during the, or towards the end of the Hundred Years' War, France is going to get a lot more property. It's going to be all under France proper. And what happens is when they got more land, they ended up with Jews. So they ended up by force, but like naturally when they expanded France, so they ended up with Jews, which only meant that in 1394, they're going to expel the Jews for good. And now the Jews are not going to come back for a few hundred years. They're not going to come back for 200-300 years after this. One second, let me figure this out. 1394, 200 years, 1594. Yeah, for another 200 years. Jews are not going to be coming back to France. And that's going to be total. So during this century...
They were banished from England, and then they were banished...
In 1306, about 15 years later, they were banished from France. They were accepted back and then banished again. So it was like in and out of France up until 1394, and then they were totally banished for good. So in 1394, you had no more Jews in England and no more Jews in France. I'm not sure about South France, Provence, the Provence regions, because that was not necessarily part of the North France. It could be, even in 1394, there may have still been Jews left in South France, but that's, I'm not sure. But if there was, it wasn't that much. Okay, and all right, so it's okay. We're going to see by the next some of the things, upcoming things, the Jews are not affected because there were no Jews there. Okay. Yeah. I guess I did not get off the but okay, the Black Death. Next comes the Black Death. I know we spoke about the Black Death last year. I don't want to spend too much time about it, but it was horrific. Okay, so the Black Death, the theory is it came from boats. Italy, which is over here, did a lot of trading. They did a lot of trading with the East, especially. There were two different competing merchants. There was Venice and Genovese. So they think it came from the Genovese. But they had boats, and they would go, and they'd make their trades with even as far as China. You had the Mongolians. They made their big empire during this time. And they think that there were these rats that were diseased that ended up on the boats. And then there were these fleas that were in the rats that bit the rats, picked up the bacteria, and then bit people. So I guess if it worked like this, you had, all right, fleas drink blood that carries bacteria. Bacteria gets in the fleas, then it goes into the... It gets clogged, they bite the humans, it goes into the blood, and the human is affected. Bubonic means spread by fleas, and then it was very highly contagious. So that's, I guess, pneumonic is spread by human to human. And it just took out Europe. I just thought this is like, you know, it was called the Black Plague because it turned you black. Okay. Mortality rate 35 to 70%. They estimate this, besides the famine, This 25 million, different estimates, anywhere between 50% of Europe was killed with the Black Plague. And this wasn't the only thing that was going on at the time. Besides all this, the Jews, besides being killed by the Black Plague, and one account is in the beginning, the Jews weren't as affected by the Black Plague as the non-Jews, and simply that was because of sanitary conditions. Netilas yadayim, you know, a person, if a person has to wash their hands, how many times a day? You know, you wash your hands when you wake up in the morning, when you want to eat bread, that's three times a day. If you go daven mincha, ma'ariv, shacharis, you know, it's just you go to the bathroom. So Jews naturally are. By halacha, there's more sanitary. It's much more sanitary, and it could be that the where the Jews lived, Jews could have been overall wealthier than the average serf or peasant, and they could have lived better. They could have lived more spread out.
Jews didn't live among the goyim; they lived
right.
Outside.
Right, right. The ghettos were forming. They weren't like official ghettos like they would be. I don't think. There were sections where the Jews lived, but it wasn't like later on the shtetl or the ghettos, you know, that came upon later. But the Jews lived in better.
If you're in an area with rats or the fleas, it's going to affect everybody.
Right, right. So it did affect the Jews. It wasn't like
the Jews were
immune to it, but it wasn't hitting the Jews as much. So what happened is, and again, I guess the crazier the story, the more believability it is that they believe that the Jews were the ones that poisoned the wells. And some crazy conspiracy, the Jews somewhere decided that's it, they're going to poison all the non-Jews, and they go and they have these black boxes, and they have the poison in it, and they put that in the well, and They say these incantation with words, and people believed it. So it wasn't enough that Jews were being killed by the Black Plague, but then they were being killed and persecuted as well. Again, over here, besides that, they also had the hospitals may have started, people started moving all over, clergy was more, you know, into caring for the sick. Unemployment went down because there was nobody to work. Guilds, it was very a closed system. You had to have a lot of protexia You have to be on the inn to get into the guilds. These are all the smithies, all the professions. But they were taking in new people, inflation, productivity, standard of living. Everything went up because there was not so many people. Pessimism, art, literally, theme of death. People, they had these crazy bands of people going from town to town, whipping themselves, you know, as a penitence for this plague that was hitting all over. Okay, the path of the plague, 1348, it started here about Italy, and then it went all over. It started going north and east, north all the way through Germany into Scandinavia, Norway, into the east towards Eastern Europe, France, England, into Spain, North America, even into the Middle East. The Middle East was actually started, came from China. It was just wreaked havoc in Europe. Again, a different way, just different colors, same type of a map. You see where it started here, and then after 1 year it was through England and into South France and into Spain. And then it just worked its way up and around. There is another, it went through all the main countries, Italy, England, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Poland. I don't know why Poland is here, because it actually missed most of Poland. Okay, now what was part of it, the reasons could be there was a civil war in China, a great famine, they say the great famine of 1322, so that, I don't know if the land was weaker or many people were displaced, you know, it was 25 years earlier, you'd think that maybe everybody went back, but maybe once people were living in the cities and overcrowding in the cities, so it was just ripe for a plague to, you know, take over. There was a pestilence for with animals, unemployment, famine, disease, so a plague like this came and just wreaked havoc.
They used to throw the bodies in the water.
Yeah, so I mean, these new things that caused more things. This is an interesting map because here, I like this map. It shows you that there were certain areas that somehow were saved from the plague. Certain area, which is either this is northern France, south France, northern Spain, and this is another area, which is really Poland. Somehow, somewhy, Poland was basically spared from the plague. And it could explain why after the 1300s, starting in the 1300s, the population, the Jewish population in Poland skyrocketed. Just when it started going through the roof, and within 100, 200 years, a sizable amount of Jews are going to be there, and within 100, 200 years, Torah scholarship that's going to be the leading place is going to be Poland, and for other reasons too, which why it took a learning Torah learning took off in Poland. Other than that you could see it's the path. It started just going north and west. 25 million dead, between one third and half of the Europeans, 25% of villages depopulated, 45 to 75% of Florence. It's a Florence is just a city in Italy. Just just get the idea of like you have a city, and just take three quarters of the people of the city, boom, just wiped out. It was like just not there. I guess South Bronx, and it's later days. But 25% of villages, Venice, 60% died in a year and a half. Again, Venice is also in Italy, I guess that's where it started. Urban population, they recovered a little better. Rural took a little bit more time. Population did not get back to where it was until the 1500s or 1600s. Now, these later Middle Ages was just reduced population. It wasn't the same. The first 200 years of what we call the Middle Ages, from the 1100s to the 1300s, from the 1300s through the 1500s. Just in the Middle East, like just a little bit in Gaza, there were 10,000 dead, Aleppo 500 dead a day, Damascus 1,000 dead per day. Damascus is in Syria. They say Syria was about 400,000 dead total. The only thing is in the Middle East, it was just less. Maybe only a third of the population as opposed to a half. But it ravaged the Middle East as well.
It's like today's news.
Huh?
Looks like today's news.
Yeah, like, you know.
Dead Syria.
Right, right. For different reasons than, you know. Okay, so but that also changed the whole system of Europe. Up until the plague, it was the few controlling the many. You had the nobles and then the nobles and the knights and the clergy. They were all on top, but there weren't that many of them. Who was on the bottom? These were the serfs, the peasants, the workers, the farmers. And they were, that's it, they were exploited. There was no upward mobility. There was no way for them to get to make themselves better. When after the plague, everything changed. Everything changed. There was nothing, there was no way to, the serfs, everybody who was working there had like, you know, oh, you need me to work now. It's not like, you know, what do I need you? I have so many workers. Now, you know, okay, work for me and I'll give you more. You know, so things did change.
What brought about the end of the plague?
Huh?
What brought about the end of the plague?
It just wore itself out. I guess just, there was nobody left to kill, or, you know, people were more spread out. Maybe they started to become more careful. Just maybe they were beginning to get immune to it. I don't know. They're not even sure. I guess they, from what we know, it's called the bubonic plague, but you know, it may have been a different type of plague, or it could be immunities, or... So now all of a sudden society started having a different look to it. It was no longer a top, the few controlling the many. Now people started demanding things and getting... It was also a big blow to the church, because the church is, you know, in a religious sense, and there's a God, and there's... So now they have to deal with all this tragedy. Like, why did this all happen? Like, you know, the church also took a big hit on this, because they had to explain, you know, why is so many people dying? Why is this all happening? And, you know, you couldn't... Why is God upset with us? So it was... And people in the church died also. Why are your priests dying? Why are there's, you know, all the... So it was, in terms of their being very religious, in terms of the church being the all in all, it lost a lot of that. It's still going to be powerful. It's still going to be very influential, but it's not the way it was before. Okay, Jews. So the Jews are scapegoats, massacres, burnings by 1351, and this is massive. I guess, yeah, the Jews in all this, besides the plague, 60 major and 140 smaller Jewish communities were exterminated, destroyed, finished. I'm not sure what they mean by major. Does it mean 100 people? Does it mean 1,000 people? So I don't know. But whatever was considered major Jewish city, so that was it. 60 of them were gone. And where did they die? Were they? Many of them were killed by the local population. Some of them were just, you know, exiled, and they just moved out. Jews also expelled, moved to Poland and Lithuania. Now this is the start of the Jews moving over. Okay, just a few countries where you see in the 1300s where the Jews were exiled. 1322 before we had it in 21, but again in France, that's after 1306. 1322, Switzerland, 1348, in Germany, 1349, Saxony, which is part of the Holy Roman Empire, another country there, also 1349, Hungary, Belgium, Slovakia, Strasbourg is, I guess, France. It was one of France and Germany. I'm not sure. Is Strasbourg in France?
Germany.
If, huh?
Germany.
It's in Germany. Okay, so I thought maybe East Germany, West Germany. But Germany and France, 1394. In Germany they're exiled, in 1394 in France. Now, it doesn't mention over here, which I don't know if we'll get to tonight, but in 1391, 3 years before this, there's going to be a major, major pogrom in Spain. And you're going to have this priest, I forgot his name, he's going to go around in every community, just going to either give the choice, kill Jews or have Jews convert. And it was just for he. Takamata was later, but he went around for a whole bunch of months, and it was, and he did it when the kings were transitioning. They weren't. Some king had died, and it was nobody taking over, or there was a feud who's going to be the next king. And when that happens, so I think like about tens of thousands, if not 100,000 Jews, are going to be converted or killed in Spain in 1391. 1391 is the beginning of the end of Spanish Jewry. After 1391, Jewry in Spain is going to be nothing of what itself, and it just, the nails in the coffin is going to be 1492. It's almost like World War I was to World War II to the Jews in Europe. 1391 is going to be to 1492 to the Jews in Spain. So just keep in mind everything that's happening here, you know, in these 25 years, it's kicked out of Belgium, Slovakia, Strasbourg, Germany, and France, and there's no Jews in England, and now there's going to be a tremendous pogrom in Spain. It's just remarkable how were the Jews able to survive? How many were left of them? Where were they? Okay, well, we will see. There were places where the Jews were: the Ottoman Empire, Poland. The church overall during the Black Plague was very good to the Jews. Pope Clement, he issued bulls saying, do not kill Jews, it's not their fault, but people didn't listen. I mean, either because you don't need much not to listen to the Pope to kill Jews. I mean, it doesn't just, and to the point where the Jews were only safe, only in lands that were owned by the church. Church was the largest landowner in Europe, and that's what it was. I guess throw in the mix that the Jews were moneylenders, and they felt if they got rid of the Jews, they wouldn't have to pay the loans back. And just put that in also, and that their local priests have been from the pulpit have been saying the most terrible things about the Jews, you know, every week in their church. So you throw that all in, and the plague, and you believe these crazy things, and then blood libels, and then the trans eating from the wafers. I forgot what it's called. They ate from the wafers, they believed that was Yashka, and then they thought that somehow the Jews were able to break into a church and defame it. So they all these things were going on, all attributed to the Jews. If you think that was only what was going on, now besides all this, is a 100 years war that was going on between France and England. Now, the good news was, is that this overall didn't affect too many Jews, because there were no more Jews in England, and they were kicked out of France. They were in France at the beginning of the war. Remember, this is 1337. They were kicked out in 1332, and they kept coming back and forth until 1391. So in 1391, halfway through, then for sure there were no more Jews left. So, like, you know, I guess in the old days when we used to hear that there was a war between Iran and Iraq, like, you know, what did we, you know, okay, so let him, you know. But here it didn't affect the Jews directly as much, because there weren't that many Jews left in either in those two countries. But with the Black Plague, and with everything going on, the famines and the Black Plagues and everything, you have a war between two countries. Now, the beginning of the war started like this. Let me just go back so I have it. Okay, basically what happened is Philip, Philip the Fourth died without any, I'm sorry, Charles the Fourth died without any children. So the question is who's going to, who gets succession, who gets the next one? So if you look over here, Philip the Charles the Fourth, so Philip the Fourth was king, and his son Charles became the next king. Okay, so now Charles died. Okay, who becomes the next king? Actually, what first happened is Louis the Tenth, and then his brother, and now Charles. So he didn't have any children, he didn't have any children, he didn't have any children. So who's next? So it, one way to get next is, well, if you go back up to Philip the Third, Philip the Third had a son, Charles of Valois, who had a son, Philip, Philip the Sixth. So maybe Philip the Sixth should be king. Or do you do like this? Philip the Fourth, is after three boys, had a girl, Isabella. Now, Isabella was married to Edward the Second, who was the king, actually, who's Edward the Second, and whose son, Edward the Third, was king of England. So the king, the French did not want the king of England to be their king as well. So they chose, they went back and they did the excuse, well, it can't go through a... can't go through a woman, the women do not inherit, you know, I guess, you know, whatever. It wouldn't go well over these days, you know, women, I guess, back then in Europe, you know. All right, but they said they didn't want to inherit through a woman, and that was their excuse to say, well, let's go up to Charles, and then we go to Philip the Sixth. He is the new king. Well, you could imagine that Edward the Third really did not like that. And therefore, he decided that it was... up to him to fix things up. And basically what happened is there was a war that lasted 100 years. And not that they were fighting every day, but there were different battles. There were four major, major battles that happened during that time. And all four was won by England. And yet they still lost everything. I'm not sure exactly. Oh, you'll see why in a second. But... okay, so in 1328, I guess a little bit before the war, England only had these two places. Now, if you, I don't know if you remember that when we spoke about England, when Richard the Lionhearted, Richard the First, was king, they had a lot of areas. There was a lot of France that England had, a lot of areas. Then when Edward the Second took over, he lost a lot of stuff. He lost just, he just wasn't, he was the one also that exiled the Jews, if I'm not mistaken, but that, he was just a, he lost a lot of land. So, they, I guess they still had two areas of land, that was in 1328. In, okay, this is English, of course they claim this. They always had like English holdings over here. And they get it because of the marriages. You know, if you're married to Queen, you know, you're married to the Duke's daughter, and when the Duke dies, you become the heir of this place. So a lot of these times they get land based on, you know, they inherit it from their spouse or from the parent. Okay, so, he confiscates Aquitaine in 1337. But at that time, France was very broken up. They weren't as united as England was. And the French, they did not like Philip VI. They wanted to keep their independence. So they figured the way to keep their independence is go for the side of England. So a lot of the French vassals, the French nobles, sided with England, and it just made for a very messy situation. One other thing is an area up north, Flanders. So Flanders was, I guess, a French fief or whatever, and they had a trade with England in with wool. And they wanted to keep their independence, so they actually called in the King of England, and they said, "We're on your side. We don't want to be part of the. We want to keep our independence. We want you to be king." And you know, that's Flanders went with the side of England, and many places also did. In 1360, this is what the map looked like. You had these two areas up here, and now this area became a lot more. And one of the things that the English had, and there are a number of battles that are in history that are known as change, you know, battles that like really set the change in course. And one of them, I'm not sure if it was, I don't know how you call it, is this Crecy? How do you call this place? Crecy, or Agincourt? They were tremendously outnumbered by the French, but the English used their longbows very effectively, and they were able to hold off much larger army of France. So they won these battles, and it was known as a big deal that England won those specific battles. And one of them they attributed to was the longbow, was that they had very good archers. Now we're in 1429. In 1429, this is what the map looked like. So England looked like they were doing very, very well. Now this is 100 years later, so everybody's dead. At least the original kings are dead. They just keep going on with this. And it's just like hard to imagine, like the French people, and it's going to affect everybody because there's going to be revolts and everything. But what ended up happening is Joan of Arc. You know, she had some sort of vision that she's going to win for the French, and she actually did. And she got everybody together, and the French rallied, and eventually they were successful over the English.
She got a good reward for it.
Yeah, she got killed by the English. She got burnt in the stake by England. I don't know, they caught her,
The English caught her.
Yeah, the English caught her, they burnt her to the stake. And eventually, somehow, the church, some years later, ended up making her into a saint. Saint Joan, I guess. Yeah.
A burned saint.
Huh?
A burned stake.
Burned stake, yeah. But that's what happened to Joan of Arc at the end. The consequence of the war is that England got tired of just the king asking for money and money and money, because wars are very expensive. You have to pay soldiers, you have to buy new equipment. You know, even today, what's the biggest thing in the United States GDP is the military. What are we 5%, 10%? What is, I'm not sure, but it's very, very relatively, relative to everything else on what the government spends.
They Obama cut the military budget,
right.
But half the planes don't have parts in things.
Yeah, okay, right. So, right, so okay, so thank God we have a new administration coming in, we'll get the parts again, that's all. But okay, so England, on the one hand, they develop a parliament, whereas, because they got enough with the king, you can't just keep, you know, taxing us, and we want representation, and we want a say in the matter. So the monarch lost power. However, in France, I think just almost like the opposite happened. First of all, there was physical destruction. The wars all over the place. But France eventually started to unify under the French monarch. Both had economic problems, socialism, and nationalism. Okay. I guess wars also bring about nationalism. So during this time, England and France, which were considered like cousins or very close countries, they became very, very distinct. In very separate countries. Okay, and this is 1337. This is when it started. All England had was this, and at the end, this was England. Flanders, notice, it's not really part. It still kept its Burgundy also, and there were probably one or two other parts that weren't really part of France at this time. But all in all, France became much unified by 1453. Okay, I'm going to just pick up with the church in decline and talk about the Babylonian captivity the next time. I may want to end at just 5 minutes. Tonight is really Sarbat Teves. So I guess why are we fasting? If you want just a little historical on Sarbat Teves, you were there today, right? So, there were three things that really happened with Sarbat Teves. If it was my own computer, I'd be able to just put up the Sarbat Teves PowerPoint. Three things basically happen. We're fasting for mainly three things. The main thing we're fasting is that in the destruction of the first temple, the siege around Yerushalayim started on Sarbat Teves. It would not be until Shvat Adar Nisim Iyar Sivan Tammuz, 6 months later, when the walls are going to be breached. But for 6 months since this started, the destruction, so this is one of the reasons why we fast, is when the siege started. Another thing that happened was the death of Ezra HaSofer. Now, Ezra was huge. Ezra HaSofer, his Rebbe was Baruch Ben Neriya, whose Rebbe was Yirmiyahu. Once you get to Yirmiyahu, the Navi, who's, you know, all the way up, this is like the direct line Torah Mesinai. Ezra was the one that brought, he didn't come in the first way, but he was the one that set the tone for the second Beis HaMikdash, the second Commonwealth. He was the one that constructed the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Anshei Knesset HaGdola was a group of body, a legislative body of 120 people. Today, the Knesset in Israel has 120 members fashioned after the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. It's a shame they should hopefully soon become anything like the Anshei Knesset HaGdola in greatness. You know, you say, well, a katan, gadol yeah, it should, you know. But so 100, and they did tremendous. First of all, they decided what was in Tanakh, what was in and what was out. Another thing they brought back was Ksav Ashuris. They were using script, a different type of script, Hebrew, and Ezra Sofer brought back the script that we have today in the Torah. He set the Bezins meet every Monday and Thursday, and added to Kriyas HaTorah Monday and Thursday, and he did a tremendous amount of other decrees, and he set the new Yishuv at the time, coming back with 40,000. That's about how many the Jews were at the time. He set it so strong in Torah that for the next 400 years, 420 some odd years, even longer, if that was just during the Beis HaMikdash. The Jews were so influential, and we were never on the defensive, as we were like in the first Beis HaMikdash. In the first Beis HaMikdash, the Jews were constantly being influenced by the idol worship idols around them, the foreign cultures, and the Jews for the most part were not. Maybe during the Greek time, during Hanukkah, but overall, the Jews' Torah was so strong and powerful that, if anything, monotheism was offensive. You know, it was making strides in the entire world. Christianity came out of the Jewish people, but this really all has to do with the credit of Ezra, who set the tone. The Gemara says that if the Torah would not have been given through Moshe, it could have been given through and list a few people, and among them Ezra, Sofer, Hillel, Shmuel HaKatan. These are people that were great people. So you see, Ezra was like in the circle of Moshe. He was almost like the Moshe or the Yeshua, you know, of his day. Drushes of, you know, we say in the Shemona Esrei, Ozer Moshia Umagen, right? Hashem helps and he saves and he protects. Ozer is a lower level. He just helps. You got to do it, but I'll help you. The next level is people that have more betachin than Hashem. Hashem is Hoshea, he helps. And the third level is Moshiach, he's like a total protection. Yeshua is a lashon from Hoshea. So when all the Jewish people came to Eretz Yisrael, Hashem, the Jewish people merited to have Hashem at a level of a Hoshea, of Hoshua, of saving. Chazal tell us, had the most of the Jewish people come up with Ezra, they would have also merited that, but they didn't. And therefore, they were only at the level of Ezra, coming from the name Ezra. So that was the second reason why we fast. The third reason why we fast is because of the Septuagint. Septuagint was during from 300 BCE to 200 BCE, the Jewish nation fell under the Southern Empire. There was the Northern Empire, which was Syria, the Southern Empire, which was Egypt, and Israel fell under the Southern Empire. Talmai, which was like a president, that's the name, the old Paros, Caesars, Talmai was the king, Talmai Philadelphus, before he moved to Pennsylvania, was ordered that the 70, some say 72 of the scholars of Israel come. And he didn't tell them why. Put them all in a separate room, gave them pen and a paper, a computer, whatever. He said, I want you to translate the Torah into Greek. And they did. And a tremendous amount of nisim happened. Well, all of them, without talking to one another, made 10 major changes. And they all agreed on the changes, just without talking to each other. I think there was about another 150 like small minor changes that were made as well. One of the first changes is instead of saying Bereishis Bara Elokim, which could be translated loosely, in the beginning God was created, Chas V'Shalom, so they changed it in Greek to Hashem Bara Bereishis. Hashem created in the beginning. Also in Bereishis, when Hashem speaks to the Malachim, he says, Nase Adam B'Tzalmenu, let us make man in our image. And that wouldn't go over it with the Greeks. That would be a very, very big... Rashi over there says, how could you do that? It sounds like a Avodah Zarah. So the Teretz is you see the importance. The Torah wants to give you a message, a lesson in terms of asking for advice, even from people smaller than you. Don't do it on your own. Even to the danger of people making a mistake about Avodah Zarah. When they translate it to Greek, they made it Eseh. Hashem says, I will make God in my image. And there were other changes also. And so even after the miracles, the Rabbanim at the time saw this as a very bad thing. Because what this really did is it gave a hechsher, it gave a kosher certificate to the Greek language. And with the Greek language comes Greek philosophy, Greek culture, Greek mythology, the whole thing. And that led to a strengthening of the Hellenizing of the Jews, which eventually led to the story of Hanukkah, which, etc. So they felt it as a danger. So today, the 8th of Teves, Ezra died. The 9th of Teves, this happened with the Zakenim. And the 10th of Teves was when the walls were breached. So that's tonight, actually tomorrow morning. Fair starts,
555.
I'm in Kendall. Kendall, you get an extra minute.
Hollywood
57, you get 2 minutes in, you know. Do I hear 58? Do I hear? All right, anyway, thank you so much for coming. Any questions?
So because of the fast tomorrow, we have some regular.